Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 1, A Wrinkle in Time.
Here's Aaron with the recap.
We rejoin the Smith family in Season 2 as Rick prepares to unfreeze time after spending 6 leisurely months repairing their party-ravaged house and otherwise fucking around town. Rick warns his grandkids that time might be a little weird after being paused for so long. To give them time to reacclimate, Rick gives the returning Beth and Jerry a wad of cash and sends them out for ice cream. Morty and Summer's indecisiveness fractures time into multiple planes of uncertainty, and as a result, they battle for their own existence and are hassled by time cops. Meanwhile, Beth refuses to allow a deer to die on her watch, as her servine heroics spark a legal war over a hunter's right to a deer's potential carcass.
All right, Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
This is one of my all-time favorite Rick and Morty's. You know, the fact that this is birthed out of a continuity that they could have just walked away from, like that this ridiculous, crazy, over-the-top visual spectacle. Like, when time bifurcates into 64 probabilities, it's just hilarious to kind of, as they kind of pan from, you know, to see all the nonsense going on, like Rick's suicidal shootout with himself. Like, there's just so many. It's such a great playground for Rick's personality. Him bringing up the whiteboard to prove to his grandkids what they're equal pieces of shit in his eyes. Oh, no, this is a long time coming. It's really good. I mean, the Beth and Jerry plot line is bizarre and kind of whatever, but like this core concept of the time being fractured and the uncertainty is brilliant, and they go for broke and realizing it, and it's just fun all the way to the stinger, which is also one of my all time favorite stingers.
Yeah, it's
Einstein
a good one.
Getting the shit kicked out of my time cops and vowing
revenge.
I feel fuck with time.
Yeah,
it's so good. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this episode is super ambitious in its concept. I have some fairly minor complaints with like the way it resolves, and it doesn't quite hang together as elegantly as some other episodes. But man, the core concept of the Rick and Morty and Summer adventure is so good, and they deal with it in such an interesting way that you gotta love this episode.
Yeah,
I mean, this is, in my opinion, sort of definitive Rick and Morty.
It's one, like, you know, there are, you know, the Rick Potion number 9 we talked about, the Meeseeks episode, the Council of Ricks or Rick Encounters, but yeah, this is up there with definitive Rick and Morty. If you know, if you're a fan, you get to an episode like this, you just feel so completely satisfied. And the fact that this is the Season 2 opener, you know, if there was any like slight disappointment over the fact that we went from Council of Ricks to House Party, like this had to shut up a lot of people, because it's just, as you said, ambitious, it's entertaining. I like the fact that they took it as a challenge to kind of, you know, forge some kind of continuity off the non-cliffhanger of last season. And it's
incredibly risky. Like, think about what's happening while you're watching this on the screen. You've got multiple frames of animation going on at any one time. You don't particularly know exactly where to look. You've also got people talking over each other constantly. It's a hugely risky episode to air on television because it's so unconventional. It's so fraught with peril as far as, like, is the audience going to even be able to see or hear the things we want them to see and hear. And the animators did an amazing job. There's a lot in the commentary about that, but the animators did a great job. I think the people who mixed the sound and wrote the dialogue did an incredible job, and it all has to be there or this thing doesn't work.
And it also relies on a lot of, you just have to have faith that your audience is going to get some of this stuff. I mean, I don't want to go like the infamous Rick and Morty copypasta, but well, actually, you have to have a very high IQ to understand. But like, you have to have a pretty good working knowledge of pop culture, pop sci-fi.
Okay.
Over the last 20 years, like, you know, be familiar with Heisenberg and certainty principles and cats and And, you know, like, again, it's like, I don't, this isn't hard sci-fi, but it certainly requires a lot, and they don't bother to explain it's, but I guess I, maybe not, because, like, this episode is approachable on a level of just, like, well, this is just crazy sci-fi magic happening.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't get the Schrodinger's cat joke. Big deal, right?
Right. It's just, it's like the visual gag of all these cats is kind of, like, floating around with all these vacuous cat expressions is payoff enough. But, like, yeah, the more... The more you're familiar with, like, you know, nature and popular science and Nat Geo, the more you're probably going to appreciate all the different inside jokes and things and hints and allusions they're going to. What do we want to let's get into the episode.
I love the paranoia of Rick. It comes out again in this episode when he realizes that the thing he would never do is the thing that the others are certainly doing.
Right.
And decides that he certainly has to do it as well and begins shooting at himself.
Yeah.
And ultimately tries to kill himself in self-defense.
As all four of the, like, how they, he's like, get into the cupboard. No, think about the cupboard and then don't get in the cupboard. And he's shooting the cupboard. All four of them are shooting, and as they're all screaming, is this what you want, you sick fuck? For children to die? And they're all, like, also giggling to, like, it. Yeah.
And we get to see it all, right? We get to see the entirety of it with the four different screens.
The reason he didn't hit the button is because Morty said something stupid right at the thing, you know.
Or said something, like, that took him aback.
Yeah.
Like, you're an angry drunk. Oh, no, he might be right about that. What? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Distracted him.
It's, but he doesn't think about that. It goes right to, like, what's been in the back of his mind, which is, you know, the way to collapse all these singularities is just to kill all the other Ricks. And him frantically building that, like, 9mm with a portal gun and then putting it to his own head and then just, like, all these, like... Plus, it's also kind of badass that Rick has a pretty good... Like, he's able to keep a pretty good handle on what he thinks he might be doing, because all those shots are near misses for blowing his head off.
They sure are.
Like, he's perfectly matching his future or alternate selves, like, move for move, and it's very impressive and... Just keeping it all straight from an animation standpoint. And also, like, you know, when this time splits into four, you know, it's one thing when it splits into two, but, like, keeping track of, like, all the different things, all the different Ricks rolling around and stuff gets pretty tough.
And the animation, man. Yeah. I know a lot of it is very similar, and they could probably do some tricks with just, like, flipping stuff. But there's so much more animation in this episode than any other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seems like this is probably the worst thing in the world. The only thing it could be worse is if all 64 dimensions were point of view. Like first person point of view.
And they were at a party, right?
And they were at a party
last season, yeah.
So they, and each point of view kind of, like, flip-flops which side they're looking at, so they have to pay attention to staging and everything. Like, man, maybe for the series finale, they can actually try to kill the animators with, like...
There you go.
Maybe that's something we can do. We can keep track of, like, the animators' banes, so we can write. It's like the God, you know, paradox is like, can you think of something so crazy the animators themselves cannot animate it?
I think yes. I think that's clearly answerable.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is this idea that Rick chooses to save Morty's sacrificing himself in the process, and, you know, that obviously turns out hilariously, where he finds the necklace or the collar, he puts it on, he says, fuck you, God, I did it all myself, after begging him to save him, which I love. It's hilarious. But yeah, there's this moment of altruism from Rick, where he decides, you know what, I've lived my life, I can do this to save Morty, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna pay the ultimate price.
Yeah, it's a real thing. Like, he thought he was at the end of his rope, and he chose Morty. And, like, you could debate, like, whether the other 63 Ricks would do that. But this particular Rick that eventually got collapsed back down to the singularity did. And it's definite. But it's also... Yeah, I mean, nothing that happens later takes away from the fact that he did that. Like,
I love Morty's reaction to it, where he's like, I have this vague feeling Rick did something to help. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also like, if I was in mind to be a smug Christian, it's also entirely possible that God did intercede on Rick's behalf, and then it successfully, the intercession was successful, And then Rick, immediately, once he no longer needed God, renounced his faith in him. There's something kind of funny about that. That's a completely unfalsifiable position to take.
Right.
But
how much tolerance would God have for that?
Oh, I
mean, is God going to step in the next time when he needs him?
I hope there's like a season 5 episode where fucking Yahweh does like bigger fish on his the fry, but now Rick's
And you could even do like an episode like a Wizard of Oz, Star Trek 6 kind of thing where, you know, okay, God does intervene and like try and do something, but Rick's like, you know what, fuck this.
It's just like,
I'm
going
to get to
the
bottom of this being, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Like, yeah. Fine, you're the devil. You still have to obey the laws of science, or what the hell is the universe, you know? So
right.
I'm going to figure you out. It would be a nice bookend with the Rickful things.
Yeah, I can imagine a showdown between Rick and a literal god.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, it would be... You'd have to handle it a particular way, I feel like. But maybe not, because like you said, Star Trek 5 is the blueprint. You just make...
Is it 5?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah.
You know what? It's
you know, I haven't seen those last two very many times.
I don't know that I've seen Star Trek 5 more than one time at the theater when I originally, way back when, because
it's bad.
It's pretty bad.
It's real bad.
It's pretty bad. I mean, it's got a 65-year-old Uhura doing the alluring feather dance.
That's true.
I mean, shit. You'd think I'd have burnt a hole in that part of the VHS tape. There's a lot of other like little kind of details about Rick's personality here. Like when the Summer's on a line of inquiry that's going to hold Rick accountable for the situation they're in, and he goes, "There's no time to hold me accountable, Summer. We got like..." Mm-hmm. I think that was kind of funny. And again, I just got a real kick out of him proving mathematically that both of his grandkids are a piece of shit. And then there's all these complex equations. I wonder if that's just like pigeon math, or did someone hire a consultant from like, you know, MIT to like, what would like an asshole calculation or pain in the ass calculation look like? You know, what would the different terms be? And because there's some kind of science happening on that whiteboard.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
I don't know. This is also one of those adventures where Rick isn't able to get them out of trouble. Because, like, ultimately, the thing that gets them out of trouble is these collars.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of comes out of nowhere. It's one of the complaints I have about this episode, be it minor, though. They just kind of show up. There's no really establishing of the concept before these time aliens show up.
That happens a lot on Rick and Morty, though, doesn't it? I feel like it's also a Star Trek thing where it's like, oh, this can happen? Sure, why not? You know?
Yeah, I guess Rick usually seems more prepared for it to happen. Mm. Or like, you get the impression that Rick knew this was a possibility.
Right, like, whereas, oh, God, here comes the time cops to show up.
Yeah.
Because that's the other question I had, is like, absent... Yes, the collars fix it, but also the time cop was one of the things that split the time frame into something that Rick couldn't easily deal with. So it's like, maybe it's one of those things where if they didn't happen to show up, Rick would still solve the, save the day.
Mm-hmm.
And also that's the other thing, is like, Rick makes a big point about how his grandkids are indecisive, crazy people, but then he's the one that kicks it from 32 to 64 by Flathead or Phillips.
Yeah.
And
he's getting desperate.
Yeah. And then like, when you see the things split that last final time, the multiple Rick saying, "Oh shit." I like that. I like that a lot. Do you want to move on to Beth and Jerry's plotline?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is a head scratcher to me, because, and it's a testament that this is probably the 12th time I've seen this episode. And it's also the first time that I've actually kind of analyzed it anything more than like, am I being entertained kind of way?
Yeah.
How the fuck does Jerry do all this awesome stuff? I mean, and it's also on the back of Beth being a complete shit about fulfilling his fantasies. Like, I know they're trying to say something fundamental about, you know, how much, like, this is Jerry's idea of working in a relationship.
Uh-huh.
And maybe Beth doesn't appreciate that as much. But how does he pull it off? Like,
I don't know.
It's just, I would make me feel better about Jerry as like a capable person if I could wrap my head around, like, but all these things are just wild fantasies. The fact that you know, Cold Stone Creamery would just have a crack team of like remote ice cream technicians that you could bribe.
Yeah. So is this, does this have to do with the $500?
It's got
the,
to
like,
be.
$480 or something.
They bought the ice cream and then Jerry's like, oh, what are we going to do with the rest? You know, but like, yeah, like.
Which was only like $20. Is that right? Did they spend $480
on ice cream?
No, I don't
think so. I think they spent $20 and so they you know, had a whole bunch of what. So maybe they could bribe, but like, it's this. This whole plot is a house of cards based on wildly improbable events like
that we aren't privy to, right? That we can't see.
Like, I was in, you know, like Beth wanting to save the deer because Jerry kind of provoked her in like a poke about like, well, you know, you're really a horse surgeon, Beth, and and then like I love her kind of rolling tough on the vet.
Oh, that's a great moment.
Yeah, I wonder, like, because I imagine veterinarians have a pretty good sense of humor about that whole thing, you know? Because, like,
yeah,
arguably it's harder to be a vet, a small animal vet, than a people surgeon.
Lower stakes, I would say a broader base of knowledge required.
Yeah, and I get it. Probably most,
maybe,
you know,
I don't
vertebrate
know. Humans
mammals
are so complicated. Well,
also, I'm just thinking most vertebrate mammals probably, like, everything's kind of in the same position. But I know that's, like, you got, it's like the medicine tolerances is all over the place. Yeah. You know, like in a blood chemistry, it's probably super important.
Yeah, probably so. That line where she tells this doctor, this vet, that this deer is closer to a horse than you are to a doctor.
Right, we both know that.
Probably my favorite line in the whole episode. Maybe in the entire episode, with the exception of Rick saying, if I die in a cage, I lose a bet.
Yeah, just let me, just because of that. I also like the vet's Hippocratic oath about, like, I can allow no harm to come to an animal unless it's an abortion, euthanasia, sterilization, or, oh yes, of course, ever the many times I eat meat.
Yeah.
Like, it's like is there a Hippocratic oath for veterinarians, because they must,
to where they also have to be vegetarians.
It's got to have some pretty big caveats about, like, we can't cause harm unless it's going to reduce the total suffering or something like that. If they even have one, it might just be like, oh, fuck, it's animals. Try not to make the evening news. That's
okay.
That's the Hippocratic oath. I will not act in a way that my profession gets drug out into some kind of, you know, consumer reports feature that will make people feel gross about the profession. That's it. Just keep us out of PETA's mouth and you'll be fine. I mean, it's just this borderline unreality, and you know, the fact that, like, I guess you, as things worsen between Beth and Jerry, the things that they have to pull out of their ass to kind of have these, like, little kind of earned but not unearned, or maybe they're earned but they have shaky foundations, like these, like, little reconnections they make, where, because I you know, I don't have any problem believing that Rick, that Jerry and Beth love each other in some kind of, like, you know, easily to define way. It's just like, that's not enough for relationships to work. You know, it's what I've learned in my 43 years on this planet. You've got to have all kinds of other things that go into that mix. So, but
I guess one of those things is you got to be there when the other person needs you. And I think Jerry is in this episode. We've certainly seen Beth be there for Jerry as well. Like the Meeseeks episode.
And the writers are definitely covering themselves, like, with all these, like, they make sure that you know that this is, that you know that they know that this is ridiculous. Like, the Cold Stream Creamery guys being like, you know, these lights are for general light ice cream work. They're not going to hold all night. And
like, what the hell does that even mean?
Right.
But it's funny.
It doesn't mean anything. And then when the deer scampers off, there happens to be a Native American there to, like, give the thumbs up. Like, yes, you return the earth spirit to Mother Nature. Like, it's all at a certain point, it's like, you know, fuck it, whatever. You know, we needed this thing and we did it. And we took shots at lawyers and hunters and horse surgeons. And because I also like that, the fact that this turns into almost like a Star Trek plot. Like, you know, there's got to be a Star Trek episode where Beverly Crusher's trying. No, I just think I watched it. Like, Beverly Crusher's nursing this being back to life while the inhabitants of the planet he comes from want them to turn him over so that they can be executed. And she even. So it's like, yes, this is literally like a high concept Star Trek plot about what does life mean and what does it mean to different people and the ways you can value life differently. And
except I don't think Beverly Crusher was doing it for her ego's sake.
I mean,
which Beth definitely is.
I don't know. The I'm working on a Dr. Crusher is evil. Dr. Evil is Crusher.
All right.
Plot as I rewatch Star Trek: The Next Generation.
The last part that I want to talk about, that I really need to talk about, because I think it's probably the weakest part of the episode for me, is when they come back together at the end and Beth and Jerry get home from their adventure, and Jerry just lays into Rick and Summer and Morty about their collars. And Beth is thoroughly entertained to the point where all she can do is laugh. Rick is thoroughly cowed to the point where he doesn't even have a witty comeback to Jerry's sometimes asinine insults.
Oh, yeah, they're pretty bad.
Most of them are. Yeah, like, oh, great, you made a Power Rangers reference. Mm-hmm. Real good.
1999 called, and they want their cultural reference back.
Yeah. We've been down that road. Let's not go there again. So I don't feel like any of these characters are behaving like the characters that I know from season one.
Okay, I'm going to put on my retcon or my fan plot contrivance iron that smooths out these things and posit that the stakes ultimately are Morty being allowed to continue to do his games with Grandpa. Mm-hmm. And if there's questions asked and it gets down to, like, we had to stop time for 6 months to repair the damage of the house we caused by this intergalactic rager, and we almost caused all of ourselves to cease existing because of Grandpa and his time crystal theft. That consequence might come about. So, like, Rick has a vested interest to just take the punishment that Jerry's given now. And I also think that...
I don't know, because I've seen him time and time again just delivering an incisive, withering insult about Jerry's pathetic life, or, you know, his desperation to hold on to his marriage, just shut Jerry down completely.
That's true.
And stop asking any questions whatsoever. So I think he could do that here. I just don't know why he doesn't.
Yeah, that's what I think is going through his head. And then for Beth, I've observed throughout season one that she's got a certain artificiality around her when, like, Jerry's in her good graces. Like, she's, you know, like, well, Jerry did a good job playing his part, so I'm going to do my part of being a support, like almost like a performance, you know, like instances where Jerry, like, wants to have sex with her. I think from the first episode, and she's like, yeah, you know what? Yeah. Or whatever. There's something about, like, when they're together that it almost seems like they're aware it's a put on. Like, she's Beth smart. She knows that Jerry's not saying anything funny.
Right.
But she's on his side because he made her feel like a real heroic surgeon, the way she sees herself all the time. So,
yeah, it just seemed like a bit much.
I agree.
Except for those two things that I sort of take exception to coming together at the very end of this episode. Mm-hmm. And this being a season premiere, it felt like maybe they got too into their own heads and too into, like, what they wanted to do with season two as a whole, and didn't, like, quite connect the dots between season one's characters and season two's evolution of those characters.
Yeah.
That's at least what it felt like to me. And I'm not saying that, look, I kind of missed the stuff you're talking about with the artificiality of Beth. Hmm. So maybe I'm just not reading well enough into it, but
we're kind of like, you know, like, does Beth seem like her genuine Beth self when she was entertaining a host of Ricks from the Council of Ricks? You know, like, she's belching to get there. Like, she seems like she's vulnerable to that kind of, like, you know, fit in to, you know, go along to get along, and, like, oh, I'm a kind of a social chameleon in different situations. That's part of her character, I think.
Yeah, it could be. I view that as sort of special circumstances, and also I think she's a different person around her father than she is around Jerry.
Yeah.
To a certain degree.
Oh, for sure.
So, yeah, I mean, you could be right.
There's other things I want to say, but we're going to have to step through the portal.
Okay, let's do it.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So this is the point where we invite everyone to, all Rick and Morty veterans to assemble as we go plot to the future, opening up a portal to Dimension BM77 to access behind-the-scenes details, trivia, and spoilers for future episodes. If that's not compatible with your carbon-based form of life, then get the fuck out. I just want to say, so like that conversation we were having before the break, I think it's interesting because I've gotten from reading a lot of interviews and listening to these commentaries and, you know, listen to Dan talk about it on Harmontown that like season two was really tough creatively.
Yeah.
Because they knew that they had caught lightning in a bottle and they knew that they had this thing that could they could lash themselves through for almost infinity and satisfy all their shared interest. But they also were gripped up by that success. Like, oh, we don't want to screw it up, or,
sure,
you know, we don't want to get too formulaic, but we also definitely want to pay off some things that we've set up, and we want to have these characters learn and change and grow, but we also want to have it be like The Simpsons, where it's something that they don't ever grow out of high school, or they don't, and that's a big challenge. And as you saw, like as in your commentary for this episode, like the fans paid attention from season one, and when it looks like they're calling outside the lines a little bit on characters, they don't like it. So I feel like that they were aware of all that kind of stuff, and it's one of the reasons season two is so good, because like, you know, they wanted to exceed their own expectations, but it also seems like that they were constantly behind schedule, and like this episode feels like something that they didn't release so much as it escaped.
Yeah, you know? they talk about how this episode put them behind schedule from the jump.
Right. Like, and so that implies that they didn't have, like, I think if they had time to go back, they would probably have smoothed out some of the things with Jerry and Beth's plot line. They would have probably, you know, like the minor, like, honestly, I think the A plot is damn near flawless.
Yeah, it's great.
I even like what, so we didn't talk about this, but what did you think of like the Keegan-Michael Key appearance, as we find out in the commentaries, there's the supposed to represent the Langolier kind of time gnars.
Yeah. I heard them say that, and I've never seen the Langoliers, but I looked up the images, and yep, they look almost
they
identical.
Look exactly like it, yeah. There's also a similar concept of playing around with this episode of Legion. These beings that can gnaw on time and destroy it that way. It's kind of cool.
Huh.
It's funny because you mentioned like some things showing up without any explanation. I'm like, oh, you know, like Noah Hawley's pulling the fuck out of that on season 3 of Legion.
Yeah, and I don't care too much. This isn't like, oh, you know, this completely resolves the plot and it's the Deus Ex Machina, that kind of thing. But yeah, I like it. I think like one of the best things they do is with the gun that he's got. Which is just like sentient. It
Chris.
Seems like semi-sentient or fully sentient being Chris, he runs out in the street and gets run over.
I always liked the concept of living weapons. Like, well, I really liked that old, the last show Roddenberry developed before he died, Earth Final Conflict. They had those Skrill that were like, you know, living sentient weapons that would bond with its wearer. And like the concept of, you know, it's not just a weapon, but almost like your partner.
And then they also have that scene where Rick convinces him to turn around so he can get the gun from him, which I thought was brilliantly written.
Right.
Brilliantly? I can't speak. Brilliantly written.
Spreading. Yeah, no, I mean, because it's the most hackneyed thing in the world, and everyone involved in a scene knows it, but Rick got him on, and he's got him clutched in the crushing jaws of reason, and like, well, you can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I also liked, I love the insights into the writing process because they initially visioned like this time uncertainty as being like time earthquakes, like Rick has fracked time and now it's quaking and there are these random things that would happen that they'd have to react to, and them realizing that what really is interesting is their own decisions impacting either time is stabilizing or time is destabilizing, and the act of these, you know, random chaotic humans are stressing the time. That is so much funnier. Like the fact that Rick can have this like paranoid delusion that then splits time in two, or that Morty and Bette or Summer can be standing opposite places and that is enough to, you know, thwart Rick's genius. That stuff is really good, and I'm glad they worked it out, because the other thing they point out is that a lot of times what they do in Rick and Morty is lampoon existing time tropes, you know. And here they are, to the best of their knowledge and my knowledge too, kind of inventing one. Like this, none of this stuff about, you know, if you freeze time for too long, it destabilizes it, and it can further be destabilized by uncertainty, and it ties into the Heisenberg uncertainty principles. That's just them riffing on, you know, shit that they've seen in PBS Nova documentaries.
Yeah, DuckTales didn't do that shit.
No. I mean, not
the best
in
they did is
27
win a
episodes and 19 films of Star Trek done this. Like, that's pretty fucking impressive. Like,
you can
make your own. And it's not even on time travel. It's just on, like, the concept of manipulating time. Although they did freeze time in DuckTales. I think they did that.
They did, yeah, and they won us off a baseball game. And
Did
a lot of other shit, too.
Try for 6 months.
Yeah.
He's just doing it for an afternoon. That's tiddlywinks.
Ducks will never be the same.
Louie, Huey, fucking amateurs. One other point that I got out of this is this was kind of like a Mr. Show reunion. They had Paul F. Tompkins voicing, I think it was the lawyer, or it could have been the hunter, and Jill Talley, another series regular. Are you a big fan of Mr. Show?
I've never seen it, no.
I've only seen, like, out of context clips. Like they're like the fuck yeah that wide. That's a Mr. Show reference.
Okay,
right?
I have seen that one.
So it's like that. I've seen that passed around, but it's one of those things where I kind of want to sit down and watch that stuff.
With as many comics say it was an inspiration to them.
Yeah,
and the work they're doing now. Yeah, you kind of want to see it.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns, and myself, Ben Aaron, from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com. to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media @BaldMove.
See you next time.